open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I don't want to think about the Hollywood image of the large psychiatric facility. I don't want to have a reaction to that. I want to understand it.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, journalist and author Steve Luxenberg talks about the family secret that inspired his book, Annie's Ghosts.
I mean, the first two words of the book are the secret. You know, I mean, the secret emerged without warning or provocation on an ordinary April afternoon in 1995. It's not a book about the secret. It's a book about the search for the meaning of the secret.
Steve Luxenberg has worked for more than 30 years as a newspaper editor and reporter and is currently an associate editor at The Washington Post. Annie's Ghosts was named to The Washington Post's Best Books list of 2009, and it was also honored as a Michigan Notable Book for 2010 by the Library of Michigan. Steve spoke with guest host Marty Link, who recently sold the movie rights to her own memoir, Bootstrapper.
So we have quite a bit to talk about tonight, so I thought I would just get started with the question that I wanted to ask Steve as a writer, and that is, reviewers have called your book a memoir, a mystery, a history, but as a reader and as a writer, I was struck by your ability to tell the story, both as a son and also as a journalist. I think it takes a particular skill to be able to do that, and you must have struggled as you moved through those two roles. So I wondered if you could tell us about that.
Well, first I want to congratulate you on upstaging me here by getting a movie option.
Thank you.
Of course, when I congratulated Marty, she said, well, the movie may never get made, as we all know that problem. Seriously, it's a wonderful book. I really recommend it to you. I love saying the subtitle just so I can say the word badass. Son and journalist. You know, as a writer, you never know what the story is until you start to write it. And it came to me a little later than I probably should have realized it, that I had to be both in this story. I had to be a son, I had to be a journalist, and I had to embrace the emotions. And there are some emotions that come along with being a journalist. I had to embrace the emotions of both of those things. And sometimes I was a very bad journalist because I let the son get in the way and I didn't ask the questions that I would have asked if I wasn't involved in the story. And sometimes I was a bad son because I didn't defend my mother. I reacted as the journalist. But that's part of the story when you go after a personal tale about your own family. All those things that reviewers have called it just prove that you can't really categorize this book. And there's nobody more frustrated about that than my publisher. Because I was at Horizon Books over the weekend, and the woman at the counter leaned over to me and said, where would you like us to put your book? And I said, out front.
Good answer.
Oh, sometimes it's in psychology, sometimes it's in memoir. I said, put it next to Glass Castle. And say, two for one.
Excellent. Well, you know, in journalism school, they teach us that I is a dirty word, that you don't use the word I. When you read your newspaper, nobody wants to hear what the reporter thinks, unless it's on the editorial page. So we don't use the word I, and yet, I.
Ay, ay, ay.
So was that difficult, getting comfortable with yourself as a narrator?
You know, it wasn't difficult once I decided it was the organic way to tell the story. Mm-hmm. If I told the story as pure history, and it would have shown the weaknesses in this story much more vividly than I was willing to admit, then it would have been more a story that was my mother's story or my aunt's story, my mother the secret keeper, my aunt the secret aunt. It really was my story as well. By the time my mom had died and I was on the search for the truth about what my mom had hidden, that was the right way, I think, to tell the story once my mom had died. If my mom were still alive, I probably would never have written the book.
Well, you just took one of my questions. And the other thing that really struck me was the book is very much about secrets. And ostensibly, the biggest secret you give away on the first page. We know on the first page that your mother was a woman who was proud of being an only child. And you learn after she dies that she has a sister. Was that a conscious decision to reveal that right away at the beginning? Because I would think a less skilled writer would use that for dramatic effect at the end, just kind of a bam reveal. It's
probably a result of watching too many Columbo episodes. You know, it's not a book about the secret. It's a book about the search for the meaning of the secret. And I like to say that a secret stands at the center of the book, but the book is really about identity. It's about the identity that my mom reinvents as she... My mom always said she was an only child growing up. She also told me her name was Beth. Neither of those were true. And she also always told me to tell the truth, which... but the identity that my mom reinvented, the identity that Annie lost when she went to Eloise, the asylum outside of Detroit, where she spent 31 years, and the identities that I inherit and need to figure out all over again after I thought I understood them growing up. The first two words of the book are the secret, comma. The secret emerged without warning or provocation on an ordinary April afternoon in 1995, because that's where the story starts. I think that's, and where do we begin stories? We kind of begin stories not with the beginning, because we choose the beginning. The story begins there because that's where I begin to have a feeling about it. That's where it starts to emerge, and so that's my response to it. The book is about secrecy in the sense that I had to explore the psychology of secrecy. Why do we keep secrets? Why do we reveal them? When do we reveal them? Is there a danger to keeping them? Is there a danger to not keeping them? I think I used every synonym for the word lie in the book. Adjectives, nouns, pronouns. Mom, liar, mom, no. Now, my mom was a kind, loving, and generous person, and she was also somebody with an enormous lie. And I think that the mistake that some people make in asking me about that is to think that she's two different people. I mean, she's both people, mm-hmm. both persons. And I ask the audience, anybody, have you ever told a lie? Well, wait a minute, if we all have told lies, then what's so big a deal about my mom telling a lie? Are you proud of everything you've ever done in your life? Well, no, we're not proud of everything we've ever done. So my mom just did it several orders of magnitude greater than the rest of us.
Right, right. I wonder if you could just give us a mini profile of your mom. Just introduce us to her.
Well, the first thing that you'd know about my mom if she were out in the lobby working in the room while her son was signing books is that she would somehow manage to tell you within the first 5 minutes that she was an only child. Now, when I was growing up, I watched her do this many times. Never gave it a second thought. But after I began to realize what she was doing, which was shaping and controlling her story, I watched other people in the similar situation introduce themselves or talk about themselves in the first 15 minutes. Nobody ever tells you how many siblings they have in the first 15 minutes. So if I were paying attention when I was younger, I would have immediately learned that my mom was doing something weird. But I guess it was her way of ruling some things off. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the first time that she spent time with my wife, then my girlfriend, my wife is an only child. She thinks. All you only children out there.
Take heed.
Better do some research. My mom seized the moment and said, I'm an only child. We share a special bond. Well, the first part, I'm an only child too, no big deal. The special bond part, I mean, that's taking it to a whole new level. Mm-hmm. At the same time, my mom was somebody who was in love with books, reading. I wonder where I got that. She was somebody who should have gone to college, not because going to college is paramount, but because she wanted to and wasn't able to. She was somebody who understood that kindness got you points, and she was not above being both kind and a point getter. Mm-hmm. She was an astute observer of other people, as you, I think, have to be if you're holding a secret like she did. And she was amazingly strong. I mean, to think that you could keep a secret for 50 years, you gotta have a lot of stamina and endurance to do that. And whatever one thinks of her choice, and frankly, I don't think it was a very good choice, I admire her stamina. Boy, I could not have done it. I wouldn't have lasted longer than about 5 minutes, I think.
Right, right. Those moments of hearing her introduce herself as an only child take on, you know, they obviously take on new meaning now that you have had a chance to reflect. Some of the other things that take on meaning, I think, are your research. And if you're not a writer and you're not a historian or a librarian, you probably think research is boring, just all those dusty papers, but we know different. We know that research
is our little secret.
Oh, yes. It's the best part, and usually you don't want to let it go because that means you have to start writing.
Yeah.
Is that true for
yeah,
you?
Absolutely.
You could research forever.
Yep. I always feel like when I don't understand something and I'm writing and I say, well, I can do some more research. Yes.
And I usually have editors take things out, facts that I learned out, because they don't mean anything at all to the story, but they were so fun to learn that you feel like you need to use them in some way. But what I wondered if you could talk about your research process, and particularly about some of the photographs that you found, not necessarily the family photographs, but some of the ones from Eloise.
Well, for me, research is obviously a means to an end. A lot of genealogy societies have been interested in my book because I have to use genealogical techniques to find out a lot of the things that are in the book. But I don't consider myself a genealogy because it's kind of an insult to the genealogy community. I'm a rank amateur compared to some of the researchers that do genealogy. I'm a storyteller, and to me, it's all a means to an end. And so I wanted to find people because interviews were the only way to learn whether my mom had shared with anyone else in the world, since I'd missed the opportunity, some journalist I am, missed the opportunity to interview her while she was alive. I had chosen not to interview her because, you know, you know from the book that my mom told a psychiatrist who was asking about routine family history in 1995 that she was 4 and my aunt was 2 when Annie went off to the institution. She didn't name Annie. And my mom had no idea what happened to her. No idea. Well, I guess if you lose your sister when you're 4 years old, then you are an only child. That was me trying to reconstruct my reasons for not asking my mom about Annie. And if you don't know what happened to her, kind of what's the point? Now, why did I believe that this woman who a lie had just been exposed, that she was now telling the truth? That's a puzzle. But I did believe her. And so I didn't ask her any questions. So I had to look for substitutes. I had to look for the people my mom knew when she was growing up. Well, my mom died in 1999 at the age of 82. It was now 2006. So her contemporaries are in their late 80s. I'm in a race against time. And one of the first of her friends that I actually found, her, the woman's family, and I called all excited because I had finally found them, and they told me that she had died 2 weeks before, only reinforced that I was at a race against time. I did manage to find 2 other people who knew my mom when she was growing up and who my mom had shared, not the secret with. I mean, they didn't know, it wasn't a secret to them. They knew Annie. They knew Annie because Annie wasn't 2 years old when she went to the institution. She was 21. My mom was 23. And that meant that they had lived in the same neighborhood for Annie's entire life up to that point. And everybody knew Annie. Annie was the young girl with the deformed leg who had crutches and braces growing up, and she was a highly recognizable figure in that neighborhood. And so it's no surprise that my mom reinvented herself. Now, she only moved 11 miles away. She could have done a little bit better than that. But she reinvented herself by leaving behind the old crowd. But the old crowd was out there lurking. And I found several people who happened to run into some of the old crowd, and they said, oh, yeah, I know Annie. But I never knew about Annie. I didn't know about Annie until the cemetery, after my mom's death, sent a letter to us, a letter that ordinarily, I guess, went to my mom. asking if we wanted to have flowers planted for the spring. And this was the graves of my grandparents. And instead of it listing two graves, it listed three. And the third grave had a name next to it. And this was the first time that I knew that this alleged two-year-old was named Annie. And I don't know about you, but names matter a great deal. Mm-hmm. I can't attach any kind of a visual picture to a two-year-old with no name. But Annie, I can begin to imagine an Annie, even if I'm totally wrong about what I imagine.
Right, she becomes real.
She becomes real. And it also gave me lots of leads. I could go to the cemetery, I could find out that my mom who didn't know what happened to Annie, was the one who buried her in 1972 when Annie died at the age of 53. And I began to pull on those threads. So the research involved just trying to figure out, how do you reconstruct the past? How do you put yourself in my mom's shoes, in Annie's shoes? How do I see the world as they saw it? Not as I see it through my eyes in 2006, 7, and 8, but as they saw it in 1940, which is the year that Annie went to Eloise. That's a very difficult thing to do because you have to try to shed all of your prejudices, all of your biases. I don't want to think about the Hollywood image of the large psychiatric facility. Eloise was the largest facility of its kind in the country at the time, 5,000 psychiatric patients, 5,000 homeless and infirm patients. I don't want to have a reaction to that. I want to understand it. And I like to say that this is a book of understanding and not of judgment. I'm not sitting in judgment on my mom. I'm trying to walk in her shoes, walk in Annie's shoes.
I think that compassion for the characters is part of the engine of the book. And the other engine for me is that secret that you tell right at the beginning, the secret, on page one, another secret's revealed, another secret's revealed, the story that you just told about her being growing up with your mother, your uncle's involvement, the other relatives. So how did you deal with that as each kind of building block almost fell down as you were working on your research?
Well, one of the things that I did as a writer was to keep a journal every day of what I did every day. Because I realized I was reporting on myself, and I knew I would forget most of what I did. Because you just don't remember who you call, and you don't. Most of it isn't important, but when it is important, you need to have some memory of it.
Right. Are you a usual journal writer, or is that unusual for you?
Okay. That was unusual for me. And the other thing I did was, I didn't assume that family members were afraid of talking to me. I think a mistake that a lot of people think is that when they hear a family member say, well, I don't want to talk about the old days, that they think that's the end of the conversation. And as one of my post colleagues has said memorably, no is just the beginning of the conversation. So I always went into the conversation with a family member or a friend of my mom's, assuming that it would probably go pretty well. And you know, most people want to help you. Mm-hmm. Even the woman in Lansing who was in the bureaucracy at the community mental health department wanted to help me. Mm-hmm. As she was telling me, she couldn't tell me anything about my aunt because it was against state law. And I thought it was my job just to keep her on the phone as long as she was willing to help me. She gave me a clue to that because she said, you know, as she told me that state law prohibited her from sharing any information with me, she said, well, I have a photograph on my desk of two twin sisters, one of whom was in an institution in Michigan and one of whom was not. And the one was looking for the other, and I gave her a Social Security number, and they found each other, and they've been reunited, and they sent me a photograph because the one had been in the institution and been deinstitutionalized. Well, that's a very sweet story. I saw you with your little shake of the head there. And I'm thinking to myself, she just told me she violated the law. How can I get her to violate the law for me? So I asked her, you know, quickly trying to think of the best question, well, there's no point in seeking a court order, which is one way to get records from a hospital.
Right.
There's no point in seeking a court order if the records no longer exist. So could you just check for me and see if the records exist? Can I just throw this bait into the water and get you to take the hook? And sure enough, you know, she got interested in me and my story. And when she finally sent me some records, secrecy, She wrote a little note.
She became an ally.
And she wrote a little note that said, I hope this gives you some closure. Well, I had never mentioned any need for closure. Closure was the last thing I wanted. I wanted openness. But it was interesting to me because that was evidence that she thought she was helping me. She was emotionally involved in my psychology.
She needed to know you had closure.
She needed to know
whether you needed it or not.
No. If I wanted it or not.
Whether you wanted it or not. Let's talk a little bit about that, you know, that law. It was amazing to me how easy it was to have someone committed. And I just have a place marked here on your book, page 99, if anybody has the book. This is stunning. Under the law in effect in 1940, the father, mother, husband, wife, brother, sister, child, or guardian could petition the court to have a family member declared insane. But the legislature didn't stop there. It specifically allowed a sheriff, a superintendent of the poor, a county agent, or anyone that a judge deemed a proper person to make such a petition to come before the court and swear that a fellow citizen was mentally defective, insane, or feeble-minded, or epileptic, and needed to be confined in an institution. That's stunning to me. And yet, how difficult it was for you to get the records of a family member.
You know, every state is different. It's difficult in different ways in different places. And when people ask me, and many, many people now email me and ask for help in finding a lost relative, because they really want to help me to be more and more frustrated, I suppose. I mean, there's some good reasons why these records are confidential. But there's no good reason why somebody who was in a Michigan asylum or Michigan psychiatric facility 100 years ago, and if the records exist, why would we not allow a family member, if they could prove they were a family member, just to have those records? All the efforts that we're making to try to reduce shame and stigma, aren't we just perpetuating stigma if we tell you can't look at a medical record from 100 years ago? I mean, we can't very well argue that someone's going to discriminate against your great-grandmother,
right?
Deny her a job. So why are we doing that? Well, you could argue it's because we're protecting the hospital from a lawsuit, but we could deal with that problem. We could have you sign a piece of paper saying, I'm not interested in a lawsuit, I'm just interested in the information. Now, there are many people who will say, oh, Steve, you nosy journalist, you just want to find out everything about everybody, and it's just your curiosity, and I have no interest in your curiosity. But it's not that simple. As we learn more and more about the genetic basis for physical and mental conditions, we're going to want to know more about our past, not less. Mm-hmm. It's not curiosity when someone emails me and says that their family has a generation-skipping disease. This is an actual email. And she's always told her children, who would be in the generation that would have the disease, not to worry because her father doesn't have the disease. Until she learned that her father who raised her wasn't her father. Her biological father, she found him, and he had the disease. And it was only luck that got her to her biological father. Her children ought to know that they have this generation-skipping disease. So it's a real issue. It's not only curiosity. Although in my case, it was mostly curiosity.
Well, you can take that word openness, open records, but also being open to the possibilities and what you find and open to understanding. And you can't get that with court orders. You know, you have to have access to the information. So I was just really struck by how the contrast between how easy it was to commit someone and how difficult it was to find out about your own family member.
So interesting contrast I hadn't thought about.
Yes.
I needed you as in my editor. Can we talk about Mr. Wonderful? That's what Marty called her husband. I thought it was just a great device in her book that she didn't refer to her husband by name because the book isn't really about her husband. And she found a great way to refer to him as just Mr. Wonderful. So.
Well, that's one of the perils about writing about family and people that you know is you have to come up with things like that. Speaking of which.
I call my wife Miss Wonderful. I mean it.
Does she answer?
No, I don't do that. I'm not going to tell you what I do. No.
She's going to talk to you later.
Yes, she is.
So you say that you get emails from readers about, you know, what's the advice when someone says, how do I find a lost relative? What do you tell
if
them?
If I know, if I have a clue, which I don't always, I try to help people. I've helped so many people that my daughter one time, while I was helping somebody, looked up and said, Dad, you really ought to charge for this. And I said, no, I really shouldn't. But, you know, my advice, if you want one piece of advice, this you know about somebody who you want to find out something about a relative who was involuntarily committed to a hospital. It's likely in most states that there was a court proceeding. So don't think of it as a medical record. Think of it as a court record, because court records are open. And even if they include medical records, they're still open. And that may give you closure.
Mm-hmm. Well,
most people will be satisfied with the court record.
And sometimes the medical records are attached.
That's right.
But then if it's a person like you, then they go the next step and the next step and the next step. The another interesting thing to me was I read an interview with you when I was preparing to talk to you in Lansing, and you said that you did not want this to be a Holocaust book, and it's not. However, your mother's cousin Anna, not the Anna sister, but Anna cousin.
Yeah, why did everybody in the family have to be named Anna?
No.
Just, you know, I wanted to change their names just to make it easier on me.
But you can't. You're not a novelist. You can't do that.
Can't do that. I would have called them Marty or something.
With a D-I. Her story was incredible to me and so personal. What was that like talking to her? She told you the story of escaping from the Nazis.
Well, one of the reasons why I said I didn't want it to be a Holocaust book, and one of my first sentences in one of my chapters is, I've never wanted to write about the Holocaust, is because I think it's been written about by so many people so much better than I could possibly do it, and I never wanted to delve into that subject. It appears in this book only because Anna, who was my mother's cousin, as you said, somebody I didn't know, although she claims I met her when I was very small, like 2 years old or something, because she was somebody who had managed to, at the age of 18, escape the massacre that took most of the Jews in her town in Ukraine, in the days before concentration camps. It was called the Holocaust by Bullet. She managed to escape this through the help of a German family that she was working for, put her on a train, and because she knew four languages, and she had managed to have the smarts to purchase some papers that said that she was a woman by a different name and she was half German, she went to the Wehrmacht at the Russian front and convinced them that she was half German, and they hired her as a translator. That meant that she spent the rest of the war living with the very people who had murdered her family. Well, she had to, as I say in the book, she didn't just have to tell a lie, she had to live a lie, which is a lot harder than telling a lie. And she had to believe it herself, because if she slipped up, it was possible that she could be discovered. So lying, as I write, was the route to survival. Lying was the route to safety. I didn't really want to tell Anna's story, but Anna's anger at my mother for keeping secret the existence of a living person was so raw, so personal, so powerful, that I really felt I had to understand where Anna was coming from. And where she was coming from was the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. She is from the same town that my grandparents came from. My grandparents came to the United States before World War I. It's a small town, but it is a town, not a shtetl, named Radzivilov. It's in the western Ukraine. Everybody knows where Ukraine is now, right? Because this is in western Ukraine. It's really more Austrian than, because it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire for a long time. And I went there with my wife in 2007, and just to walk the streets. I mean, it's a very small part of the story. Before I went, I called Anna, who was 85 at that point, to tell her I was going to Ukraine and to Radzivilov. And she showed her distaste for her homeland by saying, "Don't let them stab you in the back." I said, "Anna, I think there are different people than they were back then." "Don't be so sure." But I delved into it, and the great thing about Anna as a character in the story is that, you know, she presents a problem for writers because she takes the moral high road. She's the one who's outraged that my mother is keeping this secret, and I don't want her to be that person because that's not interesting. Mm-hmm. That's just a scold. And then as I discover, Anna has her own secrets, and now I'm much happier with her as a character.
Right. Right, and it took a few visits to get her to tell you. That couldn't have been your easiest interview.
She didn't tell it to me directly, her son told me,
right.
And then I had to, but it was interesting, when I revealed to her that I knew her secret, she was unfazed. She just went on and told me all about it and why she had done it. And I asked her, don't you see this kind of a parallel between you and my mom? No, I don't see it at all.
And she had the least compassion for your mother.
Least compassion. And it made it very difficult for me as a son to hear it. And that's what I was referring to when you asked your first question about why I felt I didn't do a very good job sometimes as a journalist, because I listened to I didn't tape very many interviews, but I listened to the recording of my interview with Anna the first time, and I thought, boy, you did a lousy job in asking questions. Because I was just dumbstruck by the whole thing. And I didn't know what to say, so I just let the tape recorder run.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Anna, the cousin Anna in the story, carries our anger, carries the reader's anger, because partway through the book, I'm pretty angry at your mom, and Anna does that for the reader. So she's not just a scold; she serves that.
Yes, well, that's exactly what I think. Those readers who would identify with her anger will like what she's saying.
Right.
But of course, as the father of a playwright, I kind of like the ambiguity creeping back into the story.
Right, yes.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, readings from both Steve Luxenburg and Marty Link.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in downtown Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to Marty Link's conversation with Steve Luxenburg, author of the book Annie's Ghosts.
Another question that I had for you, still on the secret theme, you interviewed a historian, Deborah Cohn, at Brown University. And she, and I'm...
I didn't interview her because her last name was Cohen, which is also my grandparents' name. I really did try to find somebody who knew something about what she was talking about.
Right. The name was just a coincidence. Yeah. And I did a little cutting here just to make it quicker, but this was what she told you about secrets. And she doesn't really take a stand. She takes two stands. As a historian, she says, I think secrets shouldn't be allowed to survive the people who kept them. But you come along with a particular stake, and that's the complicated part to me. Why is it that we have a compulsion to reveal? Shouldn't some things be allowed to be secrets? So on the one hand, she's saying, go ahead, reveal whatever you want. But then on the other hand, she's saying, shouldn't some things still be secrets? So what did you get from that interview, and what are your thoughts on?
Well, I like Deborah very much, and what I got from it is that she was writing a book about secrets of her own in Britain, and so she was kind of trying out her thoughts on me. No, that's true. She has a terrific book about secrets through three generations of British history and the development of what she calls the confessional culture and how we are now all about revealing and not about keeping secrets.
Right.
Part of what I'm doing in the book is trying to understand the nature of secrecy. I'm trying to understand the value of telling secrets and the value of keeping them. It's clear to me that whether one approves of Anna's working for the Wehrmacht or not, that we would certainly approve of her instinct for survival.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the most basic of human instincts is to survive. And so that's a good secret. No one should have to tell anybody that here's a reason to kill me. On the other hand, what's the value of me telling this story? Is it just my own family story? If it's just my own family story, I should write it for the family and not reveal it to anybody else. So I had to answer the question for myself, what is the value of this story? And Deborah's one of my routes to that. I'm trying my own thoughts out. And I came to the conclusion that my mother was damaged by her secret. It was destructive for my mom to keep her secret. It's not destructive to keep all secrets, it's just destructive in my mom's case. She would have been better off had she had the courage to reveal it. Now, I think my mom's reasons for keeping the secret changed from one decade to the next. Who knows why she created it? I hope people will read the book and discover some of my thinking about it. But whether it was because of my father and whether he knew, whether it was because she had children, whether it was because she was stuck with it, I think after a while you're just stuck with what you've done, and it's much harder to reopen it and go back on what you've done. But I finally concluded, and I'm going to tell a little story about an email, another emailer that no, this is not an email, this is a talk that I gave. So somebody came up to me with the book in their hand, wanted me to autograph it, but she said to me privately, I want you to know that I took your book to our Thanksgiving dinner 2 Thanksgivings ago. And I said to everyone needs to read this book because we have a family secret and we're not willing to talk about it and it's hurting our family. And everybody did read it, she said, and the following Thanksgiving, they finally talked about this secret that they'd never been able to talk about. And then she said to me, so thank you for writing the book and helping my family. Now, if that's the only person I ever meet, and it is the only person I've ever met who's told me that story, that's the person I hoped would read this kind of a book, to discover that secrets can be revealed and that there's safety in that revelation. So that was my goal in talking to Deborah, was to kind of work through some of those issues. And I don't know whether every writer does this, but if you're tired of the word I, it's better to go off and interview somebody else and let them tell you what you think.
There's also safety in families, I think, in some families to reveal secrets.
Well, there's danger in a lot of families too, but yes.
Right, but in your family, even though people had differing opinions on what you should do with this information once you had it, you were also civilized about it with you and your siblings. They didn't talk about that a little bit, because they didn't have the same feeling that you did. You had that journalist instinct to let's find out what's really going on. They didn't all have that.
No, they didn't. Although my sister, you know, can't tell you how many times she put her foot in my back and said, go find out more. My sister was the most gung-ho. Because I think that she's my father's child by a first marriage, as is my older sister. I have 2 older sisters, both my father's children. And my mom had the 3 boys that followed. And my sister was born in 1940 when Annie went to Eloise. And she has some memories, not very well defined, of whispers and secrets and rumors and things that she can't really put her finger on, but she thinks that she knew something was amiss in the first 4 years. Now, she wasn't living with my mom. My mom and my dad met in 1942, and she began living with my mom full time when she was 4 years old in 1944, 45-ish. So she was gung-ho. My younger brother was kind of like me. This is really interesting. It's kind of curious. My older brother was skeptical, highly skeptical. But he wasn't skeptical, I don't think, on the dirty linen trope.
Right.
You know, he didn't have any problem there, really. What he said was, I don't understand why you care. My older brother, I'd say in the book that my family was all about the future. We weren't about the past. We weren't going to let anything hold us back. We weren't going to be brought down by our background. My brother was the president of that society. And he said, you're never going to find out what mom thought because she's dead. And I said, yeah. Lincoln died about 100 years ago, and we still get 12 books about him every year. It's not the only way to tell history. And we teased back and forth. And I knew it was OK. If he had really objected, I probably never would have written this book. Mm-hmm. But not because I would have let him control the decision, but because you need encouragement, you need support. And if he had just been really unhappy, I would have had to weigh his unhappiness versus my desire to write the book. But I know that he was okay because as soon as the book came out, he started writing me little notes. You know, never knew you were such a great detective, knew you were a great writer. How did the book tour go? You know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I knew he was fine with the book. And then one time when we both happened to be in the same city at the same time, he actually asked to come to the bookstore with me, which I think was his way of saying, right on, guy.
Right, stamp of approval.
Yeah.
Were there things that you didn't tell because you wouldn't?
My editor would tell you no because it was much too long. No, I didn't omit anything. You know, I think that readers are very smart. They're very perceptive. And if you start leaving things out of a story, they're gonna suss you out. Mm-hmm. They're gonna know that you're not being honest. So I felt that if I was gonna start down this road of a family story, I had to tell the relevant things. You don't tell everything because it's not relevant. And I think I did a pretty good job. I wish I had been able to find out more about Annie. Mm-hmm. Annie's the weakest part of the story, mm-hmm. in a way.
And no picture.
No picture. No picture still.
Right.
I have met people since the book came out who knew Annie, and I didn't manage to find them during the research. Shame on me. Who've told me a little bit more about Annie. It doesn't change the story too much, but you know, I can tell you about the arc of Annie's life, but I can't really tell you about her days. Mm-hmm. Can't tell you how she spent her days. One of my favorite little research moments was when I paid $65 to get one line of the 1950 census.
$65 is a fortune for writers, by the way.
Yes. Before we were at a reception, they talked about wealth management for some reason, and I never heard writers and wealth management in the
Steve
same...
No, Steve and I felt like we had to leave.
Now, how many of you out there have done genealogy? Aren't you a little shocked that I just said that I got something from the 1950 census, which hasn't been released yet? So you may not know that you can pay $65 to prove, if you can prove that you're the family member, and you will get that one-line entry on your family. You will not see a census sheet. They will send it to you with everything else not there, just the one line. And I did it because I wanted to see what building Annie lived in. Eloise had 75 buildings, 20 buildings that were residences. And I wanted to know if she lived in building A or B or C or D or E or F or G or H or I or J or K or L or M and N. And you know, when you got that one, my $65 got me nothing. Because it wasn't required to put down what building she lived in. She was just part of an alphabetized list. I'm assuming, because that's what it was in the 1930 census. There was just a long list of patients. I was hoping that by 1950, they might have given her an address, but there was no address. So that's the kind of anonymity, that's what I meant when I say that Annie became kind of anonymous when she went in. All patients would have become anonymous. Mm-hmm. Why did I care what building she lived in? It wasn't a fact that I cared to put in the book. I wanted to go find people who had worked in building K, which was the likely place that she might have lived because it was a female residence. I could cut down the list a little bit because some were male residences and some were female residences. But I never did find what building she lived in, and I never found any staff member who knew her.
Just that says so much, though, that you got nothing for...
Yes.
You know,
because you're a
recorded.
Writer and you know that we're going to pretend that getting nothing can be a strength.
Right. Well, mentally or emotionally.
No, but it does say something.
It does.
It does say something about the way we treated people with a mental health problem that we can find so little about them that they've become lost to us.
Right.
So yes. I have met people who... I had a phone call conversation with a woman who played with Annie when she was 14 and the woman who I was speaking with was 7 or 8 years old. And Pearl was her name, and Pearl had many pearls of wisdom. And she said that Annie was 14, and Annie had a lot of insight and ability to understand her position in the world, but she had some developmental disability issues. And so they were kind of on the same age mm-hmm. level when Annie was 14 and this girl was 8. Unfortunately, the book was published and there was no way to include any of what she said in it, but it was fascinating talking to her because she said despite Annie's leg problems, they had no problem playing outside together, which I thought was really interesting.
That's nice. It's nice to know. Yeah. Although it's, you know, there is some sadness about the fact that you couldn't talk to your mother about this. By writing the book, you have gotten to know your mother so much better, I think, than many of us know our parents. If you could, and this will probably wrap up our interview and then we can do our reading, but if you could ask your mother one thing today, what would it be?
Well, it wouldn't be, Mom, did you want me to write this book? Are you kidding me? Although she probably would, you know, she was always so proud of her children. I think she would manage to even be proud of this. What would I ask her? That's a great question. You know, I'm not going to duck it, but I think that if I was able to ask the question, I probably would start with, if I was being straightforward, I would say, Mom, why are you so afraid that I'm going to think badly of you if you tell me about your secret? Because I don't. Just to make it safe for her, because it wasn't safe, I don't think. But would that be the first question? I don't know what it would be the first question. Once the gates would be open, it becomes my mom's story to mm-hmm. tell, and I would just listen and ask questions and guide her along. I think once the safety valve was open, I don't think my mom would have had a hard time talking about it. I include a scene in the book in which my mom reveals to me as when I'm an adult that she had an abortion. Something that was also a secret. Now, why did I put that in the book? I put it in the book because you would think for a lot of people it would be hard to tell their son about having an abortion.
Right.
But she told me that. And in contrast, she was keeping this other thing a secret. It doesn't matter what I think is tough. What matters is what my mom thought was tough. Mm-hmm. And obviously the toughest thing for my mom was revealing that she had her sister. So tough that when she was in a psychiatric institution for 2 weeks herself, a psychiatric floor at a hospital in 1995, which she had gone into voluntarily. She was not involuntarily committed. She called the next day. Why was she there? She was there because the psychiatrist to whom she had revealed that she had a sister, although she never told him it was a secret, she just said, I had a sister. He wanted to give her medication for her anxiety, or what appeared to be anxiety. She was ending up in the hospital a lot with shortness of breath, and as an emphysema sufferer, there was a physical reason for it, but he wanted to give her this medication, and he didn't feel comfortable because one of the side effects of the medication he thought would work best was respiratory arrest. It was a small chance, a small risk. He said, I'll feel much more comfortable if you come to the hospital and we can have you here for a couple of weeks and see how you fare with the medication. Sounds pretty easy, right? So my mom agrees, goes to the hospital. Next morning, she calls at 7:30. I'm with my sister in the apartment where my mom lived in Farmington Hills. And she says, Stephen, I can't stay here. You have to take me home. Well, you know, we just made this huge decision. My mom had made this huge decision. I knew that she was going to want to back out. So I'm temporizing. I'm stalling. Well, Mom will be there in a few hours. No, I can't stay here. You have to take me home. Please bring things. You know, I need some clothes, etc. Yes, Mom, we'll be there in a little bit. So I get there, and she's desperate to get out. Desperate. She's begging, pleading, cajoling. We switch roles. I become the parent. She becomes the child. Bribery was not beneath her. She was going to do anything if I would just take her home. And I don't know what the right thing to do is. My sister has already decided the right thing to do, which is that Mom should stay there and take the medication. But I'm not sure. And I'm trying to assess the situation. My mom, at one point, falls to her knees and grabs me around the shins and says, you have to take me home. You don't understand. I can't stay here. And I said to her, Mom, I understand. I saw them take away your pencils when you entered, the pencils that you use to do the crossword puzzles that you like to do every day. I saw the other patients, some of whom are screaming or shouting without any apparent reason. I wouldn't want to be here either. I wasn't really listening. I didn't really get it. I didn't know that Annie was supposed to go to Eloise for 2 weeks on a temporary commitment because I didn't know that I didn't know anything about Annie. I didn't believe that she really existed. I didn't know that my mom feared that she was becoming my sister, or her sister. And so at that moment, though, the more profound thing was, here she's desperate, she'll do anything. I mean, when you sink to your knees in front of your own son and beg to be taken home, why don't you just say, I had a sister who was in an institution, that's why I can't tell you, I can't stay here. If she couldn't bring herself to do that at that moment, she was never going to reveal this secret. It was just something she was stuck with, that she stuck herself with. That's the power of the secret, and that's why I think the secret controlled my mom. My mom didn't control her secret.
Right. Well, thank you for your compassionate book.
Well, thanks for interviewing me.
And I've enjoyed interviewing you 2 times now, so thank you.
You know, we're going to have to do this again, but next time, it's my turn. I got so many things to say about the... Hey,
well, we're going to...
Just came out today, paperback. Okay, so we've been asked to read a little bit, which I'm not sure either one of us really is all that eager
Meh.
To do.
Yeah. Meh.
Like, I'm not in love with my words. Are you in love with your words?
I'm sick of them.
You are. Well, I have an idea then. Why don't you read my book and I'll read your book?
Perfect idea.
Really?
Turn the tables a little
bit
on the National Writers' Day.
Okay, all right.
We didn't tell them
we were doing this.
Though. We're the bad kids in the back of the classroom.
Well, she's a bad kid. I'm the do-good.
Are you going to go first or am I?
I don't know. I think I'll go first.
All right.
I'm going to stand up here. Because even though I can't see you, I'm going to pretend I can see you. I'm going to give you a little background here, because I can't read the whole thing. It's very short. Don't fall asleep. So Marty's going to go. She's separated from her husband. I don't think the divorce has occurred
I'm
yet.
I'm divorced,
You're
yeah.
divorced now. Okay. She's going to go on a date with somebody for the first time in a while. And she's all anxious about it. And she decides to wear what she calls the ugly brown, which is a sweater that I don't know why she wears it if she calls it the ugly brown. And I always like the idea that I'm going to read, maybe I should try my Dorothy Michaels voice. So I'm Rachel Weisz, who's going to play Marty in the movie. I've always wanted to be Rachel Weisz. So you have to imagine this scene here, okay? You're going to get this because it's the middle of March in Traverse City. We're just past the middle of March. I'm almost to my minivan when a flash freeze of wind aims itself right at me like a stun grenade. According to the calendar, it's the middle of March, and winter is supposed to be on the downslope, but just try telling that to the weather. I angle my torso like a ski jumper, arms tight to my sides, and enter the whipping snow. Ugly brown, the sweater. Ugly brown is flapping away in this gale that feels like it's been saving up since somewhere over the western prairies just to blast me and my little acreage. While I've been inside getting ready, this wind has sculpted snowdrifts in front of my door, next to my farm truck, and over the hood of my minivan. The distance from my garage door to the end of my driveway is about half the length of a football field. Boy, not in Baltimore. But I can see that the road itself is pretty clear, and it's just my driveway that looks like a scene from Dr. Zhivago. If I can just ram my way through 50 yards of oscillating 3-foot snowdrifts, you see, I told you you didn't prepare me for... The ones that seem to have arms reaching out for unsuspecting and preoccupied women like me, I'll be fine. Because here's the deal. Here's the deal. Once I'm driving down the road toward the nightclub with my 2 free tickets to a concert that she had won, I'll be out in the town on a Saturday night as a single woman with plans to meet someone of the opposite sex for the first time since, no lie, the Reagan administration. I skipped the minivan and decided to take the farm truck instead. It chug-a-lugs the gas, and economics is a big part of the story, so she's really committed to this date. It chug-a-lugs the gas, but it also has beefy tires and 4-wheel drive, making it a better hedge against all those icy drifts, now standing between Pete, the date, and me. And it's not until my gloved hand is on the door handle that I notice how well my brown roots are showing. My brown ankle boots and my ugly brown sweater are all color coordinated with my transportation option of the evening. My farm truck, Cookie.
Well, you do a very nice Rachel, to say.
Well, I hope that when you meet Rachel, if you meet Rachel, you tell her. You tell her how good I
do. What a fantastic
how well
job
I do. All right.
Well, he's going to kill me for saying this, but the man that I went out on that date with is my husband now, and he's sitting in the front row.
Wherever you are, Pete, I want you to know I didn't choose that passage.
Now I'm really in trouble.
Hey, truth tellers.
Truth tellers. So I get to read some of Annie's ghosts. And I don't have the setup that you had for mine.
Well, it's because yours is more complicated. You have a setup.
But we're talking about, we're going back some time when you were a kid. And so this passage shows a little bit about the relationship between Steve and his mom when she was still alive. As soon as I come into the house, the aroma of oil paint hits my nostrils, and I know Mom's been back at the canvas again. It's the early 1960s, which makes me 10 or 11 years old. And Mom's paint-by-number projects have joined bridge and crossword puzzles as her primary leisure time activities. After months of watching her at work, I ask if I can try it. If she will let me do a piece of the windmill. Was that the one, or was it the portrait of the girl with the long golden hair? And I'm thrilled when she says yes, thrilled that she trusts me enough to give me a chance. She shows me how to hold the brush, how to dip the tip into the paint so that I don't get too much on the very fine bristles. I'm nervous, worried that I'm going to make a mistake, that I'll go outside the lines or put color number 3 where color number 8 is supposed to go, and then I'll ruin the whole thing. I'm not thinking about why she might have taken up this particular hobby, whether it's some sort of therapy or escape. She's never been an artist, and I'm old enough to understand that paint by number isn't real art. Although not quite old enough to understand that a real artist wouldn't touch a paint-by-number canvas except perhaps to whitewash it. But at this moment, none of that matters. All that matters is the brush and the paint and Mom sitting nearby and the magic of making something appear out of nothing, of bringing life to what was hidden in the numbers. Thank you. It's good.
That was Steve Luxenberg at the National Writers Series talking with Marty Link. Luxenberg is the author of Annie's Ghosts. Next time on the broadcast, Anchi Min, author of the best-selling memoir Red Azalea. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockenpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melkerick.